I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how a shattered city kept its soul intact through the terrors of the Syrian civil war. BBC News reporter Mike Thompson will join us to tell the remarkable story of Deraya. While it was cut off from outside food and medical supplies for years by fighting between the Syrian Free Army and the government, its residents risked their lives to set up a secret underground library stocked with books rescued from the rubble of bombed-out buildings. Our conversation starts after a short break. That stretched into years, the small Syrian city of Deraya was blockaded and bombarded. People who didn't leave when the fighting began found they couldn't leave, and the government, intent on weakening anti-Assad fighters in Deraya, wouldn't let in relief supplies of any kind. The people there often went hungry and rarely went out for fear of attracting sniper fire. But the residents of Deraya were willing to risk their lives to keep their souls fed and their minds strong, which is how they ended up building an underground library with thousands of books retrieved under cover of darkness from what was left of bombed-out buildings. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Mike Thompson is a reporter for BBC News who was astonished to discover that such an oasis of knowledge and culture could spring up amid so much suffering and violence. He shares what he learned in his new book, Syria's Secret Library, Reading and Redemption in a Town Under Siege. He joins us from the BBC in London to talk about it. Mike, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's good to be here.
What sort of place was Deraya before the fighting started?
Well, Deraya was a sort of satellite town for Damascus. It's right on the doorstep of the capital, Damascus. And it's a place where living was a bit more affordable than in the city centre. It's quite a sort of a rural town. It had a very active business in the making of furniture and agriculture. It was famous for its grapes, for instance. The Deraya grape was supposed to be the best in the country, if not the best in the world. It was a close-knit place where, even though there was something like 80,000 people, just about everyone seemed to know everyone else.
And lots of extended family relationships, I guess, helped to knit people together as well.
Absolutely. A very close-knit society.
How political was Deraya before the Syrian civil war broke out?
Well, Deraya had long been a political place. It had, for decades, been a sort of a centre for peaceful protest. There had long been young people who protested about not just President Assad's regime, the current president, but his father as well, protesting about the lack of civil liberties. But always there was this emphasis on peaceful protest. And in fact, one protester who led them about 10 years ago was nicknamed the Little Gandhi because he took to putting flowers in the end of Syrian soldiers' guns and giving them glasses of water to cool them down, emphasising that they were people like everyone else, and if they were treated with respect, they would start to see the protesters' point of view. Sadly, that didn't ultimately happen.
So what you're describing here is the youth group of Deraya, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Mm-hmm. And why were they, if they were peaceful in their pro-democracy demonstrations, why would they come in for such targeting by the Syrian government?
Well, this town had long been a thorn in the side of the Assad regime. It's right, as I said, on the doorstep, so it was particularly aggravating for them that such defiance existed there. And also, of course, the numbers of people on the streets, not just in Deraya, but also in Damascus itself and in other Syrian cities, was growing and growing. So the feeling was, I think, in Assad's government that he had to try and do something to stop this momentum. And so the methods of repression, the methods to stop these street protests, grew from sort of water cannons and just a steely presence of security forces to live bullets and beatings. And it was when that happened that things changed rapidly.
So many of Deraya's residents left after the fighting got bad. Where did they go?
Yes, many. They went mainly to Damascus, but some went to rural areas beyond that. And the population reduced from around about 80,000 in Deraya itself to just about 8,000. And many of those who remained were young men, although there were still children and there were families, but the majority were young men, many of whom had been at university and their studies had been stopped by the war, and in fact initially by their own protests, because some were told not to come back to the university because the security forces had singled them out and they'd be arrested. Others were worried about being conscripted into the army, and so Dorea sort of formed this little nucleus of those opposed to the regime. And in 2012, about a year after the Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Spring, became a civil war, the Syrian forces, Syrian government forces, came into Deraya, and by all accounts there was a massacre there of local people. The numbers killed vary hugely in estimates, from something like about 150, right up to around 700 or 800. And it was after that that the siege started, and the people who could get out got out.
So you write about a college student named Abdul Basit, and he hated being separated from his family, but he felt like he had to remain.
Yes, his family, when they left, his mother said to him, "Look, why aren't you coming with us?" And he looked at her and he said, "Look, mother, I could do that, but surely you understand, look into your heart, you understand that what's a young man like me, how they're going to feel if they leave a town like this in this sort of situation. I have to stay." And he said that he's always wonderfully poetic, Abdul Basit. And he said she looked back at him and she said her eyes were brimming with tears, but she said nothing. She didn't argue, that she knew that I really had to stay.
And then there came a point where nobody else could leave. How did Syrian government forces manage to cut the town off from outside supplies?
Well, they surrounded it completely. It was a big ring of steel around Deraya, and it was very difficult for people to come or go. And many government snipers would be in the tall buildings that ringed the perimeter of the Deraya area, not just the town, but also the farmland that surrounded it, which was still at that point in the hands of the people of Deraya, and enabled them to at least get some food. But this was enforced throughout, and it was almost impossible for anyone to get out. Although, of course, as in many wars, you have a sort of illegal economy whereby some corrupt Syrian soldiers would allow stuff to pass through for a price. In fact, they even landed up selling weapons, the very weapons that would then be used against themselves.
Wow. To
the rebel forces there defending the town, and sometimes would even actually deliver the weapons themselves.
So when you say rebel forces, these are, as you mentioned, mostly, you know, college students who aren't able to continue with their studies while all this is going on. What sort of training did those rebel fighters have?
Well, it was fairly rudimentary, but they also had some Free Syrian Army fighters with them to instruct them. And these were the sort of moderate, a bit like the people of Deraya itself, who had long protested wanting more civil rights, wanting freedom of speech, much more sort of a liberal society, not Sharia law like some of the Islamist extremists wanted. And so it was mainly these sort of moderate groups. And apparently they didn't have a uniform, because it was felt that if they had a uniform, they'd look like soldiers, perhaps a bit like government soldiers, in fact, and they didn't really want that type of situation. They had very little hierarchy, apparently, again, between the officers and the men who shared the same houses and, as they said, shared the same stories. It was a very sort of egalitarian, if you like, as a movement. And the training these people had was very limited, and many of them said to me how terribly frightened they were the first time they were involved in battle, because they'd had a very basic training and then were thrust to the front line and really quite unprepared for what was going to hit them.
And hunger at this point is already a daily reality for people.
Absolutely. Very often people had little more than a cup of watery soup to eat all day. Hunger was a terrible problem, and it got worse and worse, of course, as Syrian government forces finally began to push into Deraya and were breaking this siege. They took over all the farmland. But before that, people were growing vegetables on balconies, on roofs, sometimes even in rooms where there was a lot of sunlight would come into the room. They grew vegetables there, and of course in their gardens and any green spaces. But it was a real nightmare for them. And people, I talked to children who spoke of how they would try, and one little girl in particular called Islam, who was 12 years old, and she said, I try and play as much as I can, because the more I play and the more I read books I can get hold of, her favourite, by the way, was Little Red Riding Hood, the more I do that, the more I'm able to forget about my hunger. And actually, she brings to mind one comment about the violence, which really sort of brought everything home to me, when she said, when I see people killed, like I saw a man and he had been shot dead, and I asked myself, why did he die? What did he do? And it brings home that almost the casual terror of wars, where that presumably the person she was referring to was a civilian in the street who was perhaps hit by a bomb or a sniper or a shell, and he died, but he hadn't actually done anything to anyone.
How did you hear, Mike, rumours that there might be a secret library in Diriyah?
Ah, now that's a very good question, Chris. Yes, I was looking into, for BBC News, what life must be like for people under siege, and Diriyah was just one of the places that I looked at. And it was only on talking to somebody there who I was asking, how do you survive not just the bombs and bullets, which it's hard to get away from? And all the time I was talking to him, I could hear these incredibly loud explosions that on some occasions were distorting the speakers in the studio I was in. But I said, how do you survive mentally? How do you cope with all this? It must be terrible day after day. And he said, well, the thing is, Mike, we have a secret weapon. And when he said that, I was imagining some sort of nuclear device, or I don't know, some sort of secret weapon that was of the more traditional kind. It was only when he said, our weapon is our secret library. That's where we go to escape the terrors, the horrors of war. And that's where we go to find peace. And he started to describe, this was some months into the creation of the library, and he started to describe all the books they had, and sort of, it just came to me, this vision of, you know, there you have the sort of the hell of war, the bombs, the shells, the snipers erupting on the streets above, and just down below, just a few feet below those shattered streets, here was this, what he described to me as a literary sanctuary, this place of peace, of tranquility, of learning. It was clearly a totally different world, and it was one they could escape to by going down a few steps.
We should note that at this point, even though you're an international journalist and have done war correspondence, you, like everybody else, were prevented by the Syrian government from getting into Diriyah.
Yes.
How did you get in contact with people who remained in the town?
Well, it was one of those things, as you said, a siege is a siege, and particularly one so enforced as this, there was no getting in or out. And I did ask about this, and I was told by the people there, don't try that, because you will be killed. They said, you'll stand out and you'll die. So not that I think the BBC would have let me anyway, but the only way to communicate with these people, because also most phones didn't work, most cell phones wouldn't work. So the way to do it was via social media, by the internet, via WhatsApp calls or Skype calls. And it always amazed me that here is this place besieged. They've cut it off from the outside world. They're doing their very best to make these people feel totally alone. And yet there's internet. Not all the time. And sometimes there were days went by and I couldn't talk to anyone. But that often was internet, and I could sometimes get a good enough line to be able to get a vision of people, to get film of people I was talking to. So that was utterly remarkable. It was a very, very strange feeling for me, though, because as you say, most foreign correspondents, when I'm overseas, I go to the places things are happening, and I'd never covered something like this before. Well, I'm sitting in London, and there they are, in this besieged war zone. So I at times felt almost like a sort of a journalistic voyeur, because I was able to dip in and out of this world. And when I went off, say, to have a meal in a restaurant, I was leaving them to you know, hunger and bombs.
Mike Thompson is with us from BBC News. We'll be right back. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with BBC News reporter Mike Thompson about his new book, Syria's Secret Library, Reading and Redemption in a Town Under Siege. Okay, Mike, how did people go from just fighting to stay alive to coming up with this idea for a library? I mean, it sounds nice in the abstract, but also really impractical given all of the obstacles they had.
It does, doesn't it? Yes. Well, they were sitting around saying to themselves, look, how can we occupy our minds? How can we take our thoughts away from the fact that we could be dead at any moment? And yet there's nothing we can do. We have to stay in this area. We can't leave. And someone said, look, I've been hearing that there are lots of very valuable books around this town lying in homes, abandoned homes that have been bombed, or offices, and they're open to the wind and the sun and the rain, and they're being destroyed. Let's go and collect them, and then we can put them in boxes and keep them safe. And then somebody said, don't put them in boxes. Why don't we put them out somewhere on display so that people can read them? Hmm. And somebody else shouted, yes, a library. And the idea was born.
How did they choose the site for it?
Well, what they wanted was to find somewhere that wouldn't look too attractive to bomber planes, somewhere that was already an area already half destroyed or mostly destroyed. So they said it obviously needed to be a place of relative safety, only relative, of course, in Daraya. But we need a basement. And they managed to find a basement at the bottom of a building that was almost totally destroyed in an area that was rubble. So it would look to bomber planes as if there was nothing worth bombing there. And that's where they decided to site this library. And, of course, the next thing was, you know, how do you go about getting books in a place where there are snipers everywhere, because in these tall buildings these guys had a view of most of Daraya, and there were very few areas of the town that they couldn't see, they couldn't get in their sights. So it was a very tricky operation. They had to try and keep the right side of walls and things that shielded them, or barriers they put up themselves. And often when they were trying to get books from these homes and buildings, the bottom stories were destroyed. There was no doors very often left anymore. The windows were covered in rubble. So they'd have to climb up through this rubble and somehow get into an upper window. And then, of course, they had the problem of trying to get the books out again. And books, of course, when you take a pile, are very heavy. So often they'd have to wrap them in blankets and lower them through holes in the floor, all or very often under the eyes of Free Syrian Army fighters, who would just advise them on how to keep as much as possible out of the line of sight of the snipers.
I was fascinated to learn that initially among members of the Free Syrian Army, there was some resistance to the idea of the library. Some of them loved it.
Indeed.
Some of them didn't want it. What did you find out about why there was resistance?
Well, apparently, the original name for the library was New Dawn, or approximately that, and translated, apparently, in Arabic, it's close to the word for bomb. Hmm. And they thought maybe this gave some people ideas, but there were many people, of course, who couldn't read, who were illiterate. And like in any country, there are some people with no interest in books. And, of course, there are quite a few of these other fighters thought, look, how can we be there manning the front line and putting our lives at risk every day? And these guys are sitting in a basement reading books or going out collecting books. An understandable thought, that, I think, really. Although when I put that actually to Abdul Basit and Anas, his friend, they said to me, or in fact it was Anas actually that said to me, the soul needs books just like the body needs food. Because I also said, you know, apart from the concerns of the other fighters, what about the fact that you're so short of food? Why aren't you looking for food rather than books? So some of these fighters wanted actually to blow the library up. And the only way they could find to stop them was to invite them in and let them see what happened there, let them see the fact that it wasn't just reading. There were also many other hardened fighters who these guys respected who'd used the library. In fact, just to divert slightly there, there were even libraries being held in foxholes, mini libraries, that the soldiers, these same soldiers who came in, or fighters who came into the secret library, when they couldn't get there, when they were stranded on the front line, they'd bring with them bags of books, which they called their mini libraries, and they'd hold book clubs It, believe this or not, it's absolutely true. The whole book clubs in foxholes. They'd only have one book of each, so they couldn't discuss the same book, but they'd discuss their own book and then take questions on it. But in the end, when these other fighters who wanted to get rid of the library saw that there weren't just reading sessions, there were also all sorts of meetings being held. There were talks. There were English language classes. They opened reading classes to teach these people how to read and how to write. And it wasn't long before they became won over too and loved the place.
So Daraya physically is gutted in almost every sense of the word, but the people who remained there recognized that they would stand a better chance at survival if they worked together. So tell us a little bit about this wartime civilian council, how it Yes. came together and how it functioned.
Well, the council was brought together. There had, of course, been a council before, but the siege council was brought together soon after the siege itself began. And the idea was to try and keep as many services as possible going and to try and make people feel that life was as normal as it was possible to be. And, of course, in many ways, it wasn't at all normal and there was nothing you could do. But they would make sure that people's garbage was collected, for instance. They would make sure that homes that could be repaired were repaired, which is actually something that amazed me, that homes were being destroyed, bombs were coming down, obliterating entire buildings, and other ones lacked walls or roofs. And yet the council would come round and repair windows of homes that were still standing. You know, little bits of putty in, some more glass. You know, it was extraordinary. They had a real attention to detail. And also they took charge of food supplies. What food there was, they would try and share fairly so that it wasn't just the strong that survived. There were some people who stayed in the town because they had disabilities and were unable to leave. So those people were cared for, and of course children as well were cared for, and they distribute things fairly. And fuel supplies too. There was a very limited amount of fuel, and in fact people started making their own out of some sort of combination of burning of melted plastic which they used to actually power cars, and apparently it did work. So it was just like, in a way, just like a council people listening may have locally. And they even had a media department, which is how I first got contacted by them and told about their situation and was invited to try and talk to people in the town.
So you already told us a little bit about these book collecting sorties, where they'd go out together, sometimes when it was dark, and go into bombed out houses and other kinds of buildings and get books. I have to tell you, Mike, I found it incredibly touching that all these books that went into the library were like carefully labeled so that Yes. at some point in the future they could be returned to their rightful owners.
That's right. They made absolutely sure that they said basically, we're borrowing these books. We're not like people borrow the books from the library. We borrow them from their owners, and all these books must be able to be given back to their owners at some point if they want them, or if the library should close. And the main person who handled all this was a 14-year-old boy called Amjad, who, in fact, one day I called Abdul Basit, and instead of Abdul Basit, this very young-sounding voice, which sounded about that of a 10-year-old rather than a 14-year-old, answered. And I said to him, can I speak to someone, please, about the library? And he said, well, speak to me. And I said, well, is it possible to speak to someone who runs the library? And he said, I run the library. And little Amjad started telling me, in fact, he said, there's a quote here, he says, I'm the one that writes people's names in the books that we loan out, the address of the owner. I give it a special code number, and I record when it was taken out and when it's due back. And he said to me, I even have my own office at the back of the library, and it has a sign saying management on the door. And I have my own desk, and it's small, just like me. And I was assured by other people there that that was absolutely true.
And he would get up and dust all the books every day. I mean, he
Yes.
really did take ownership of this place.
In fact, you know, if I can just read you a very short quote. He said, when I first walked into the library, it was exhilarating and a complete surprise. There were so many books. Some were piled high on top shelves that I couldn't reach. And I made my mind up to try and memorize every single book. And he'd only actually come across the library because he was in the street trying to dodge some shell fire that was coming in. And some adults saw him and they said to him, look, this is really, really dangerous to be on the streets. We can tell you a safe place to go. It's a secret library that you mustn't talk about to other people who don't know about it, unless you're told you can. And it's just over there. And they guided him to where this place was. And that was that's how he encountered it. And he said to me, I said to one of the men in charge, I want to stay here. And they agreed. And they've looked after me ever since.
What was Amjad's situation in terms of home and family? Why was he on his own?
Well, he wasn't totally on his own. His family had one of many whose home had been bombed and they had to move. And they landed up living in a basement, just all of them in this little basement, just a short distance from where the secret library was. And so, of course, in daytime, when there was often a little less bombing than sort of afternoon, evening, he would go for a walk. And that's basically what happened. He wasn't by himself all the time. It's just that he went for a walk and couldn't stand just sitting in that same cramped little space, of course, all of the time.
So the other children that were remaining in Diriyah would presumably have been going to school every day if the city weren't under siege. How did Sarah Matar find a way to serve those kids?
Well, the wonderful Sarah Matar, yes, she saw how so many of these children now were unable to go to school. And they were just sitting at home, often terribly frightened because of the bombing. And if they lived in an area of town where there was a lot of that, it was just 24-hour terror. And many of the schools had either closed down or they'd been closed by the bombs themselves. They were completely destroyed. So she, along with a friend, decided to set up a school where children could go, which landed up getting bigger and bigger as time went by. And they found, again, a bit like the secret library, an area of town that had been heavily bombed and they felt would be less of a target, and set up a classroom there. And actually, later on, they managed to refurbish some of a school nearby, an existing school, and took the children there after that. But very often they had to retreat to the basement because the bombing just got worse and worse and worse. But the kids just loved going to school. And Sarah would say to me, I was always worried that children would think the last thing we need to do or want to do at this sort of time when we're frightened for our lives is study and read books. But she said it gave them, like the adults, a great escape. It gave them purpose. And they really enjoyed learning until the very end of the siege, when the hunger got to them so much. And by the way, what they would do is they would cut out pictures of food in any of the books they had so that the children weren't tortured by the sight of food. But finally, in the end, Sarah told me that children eventually lost the will to read. They couldn't concentrate anymore for more than a few seconds at a time. Many would still turn up in school, but they'd just be sitting there.
This is Thank. I'm Chris Boyd. There were adults in the town that realized that the library and schooling were important defenses against children's recruitment to extremist groups.
Indeed, one woman I talked to there, her own son, who was 15 years old when he volunteered to fight for the defense of Diriyah, and she said, I tried to dissuade him. He was just 15. He's still a child. But he said, Mother, if I don't help, who else will? Many people have been killed. Many have left this town. There's hardly anyone defending it. I have to go. And he would ask again and again. And eventually she agreed. And she just hoped that he wouldn't get too near the centre of the fighting, given how young he was. But sadly, he was killed. And she was determined to try and avoid other children suffering that fate and try to get them to come to school and keep them away from the front line.
This library, we should say, had all kinds of books. It had Muslim books, it had Christian books, it had Syrian books, it had Western books. The library's like champions saw every book as precious.
Indeed, that's right. I mean, I was told, I asked them directly. I asked Abdul Basit and Anas, two of the people who were founders of the library. I said to them, is there any sort of censorship? I mean, for instance, Christian books. You're both religious, you're both Muslim. Do you have any censorship? Do you allow, say, Christian books or Buddhist books or whatever in the library? And they said, oh, absolutely. We have spent our lives under the censorship of Assad. A lot of it, not with lists of books we couldn't read, but knowing what books we couldn't read. And there were a lot of them. And if you were found with them, you'd be in trouble. Hmm. And they said, there's no way we were having censorship. And he said, you know, we even, in fact, rescued books from a church. We heard a church was in fire. So we went to the church and we rescued a whole load of Bibles. And he said that was because all books are precious to us and all faiths are respected by us. So we wanted to rescue those.
They had sex books?
Indeed they did. He said, do you know, we've even got what he called explicit books, and we keep them on the top shelf. So if anyone wants to borrow them, they're mainly intended for married couples or couples who are engaged to be married. And he said, if anyone wants one, they have to ask a member of staff to show them where these are and to pull one down for them. And of course, I immediately thought of 14-year-old Amjad, and I'd seen from pictures how small he was. Not only would he not be old enough, but he doubtless couldn't have reached them anyway. So I wasn't quite sure what would happen in that case.
You, as you got to know members of this community, you tracked down English translations of Syrian books that were precious to them. How did reading those books sort of enrich your understanding of your friends in Syria?
Well, it's the depth of interest in the world and in poetry and in the human condition that all over these. I mean, some of the Arabic poetry. Even when translated, and of course translating poetry to another language can often lose the magic of it, but it really didn't. Some of the poems were just wonderful, really, really moving. And of course, Syria was the sort of the birthplace of books and the first library of Ebla nearly 4,000 years ago. This is the sort of the cradle of learning. So perhaps it's not surprising that there's all these books. But it wasn't, of course, just Syrian or Arab writers. There was a great love of other things. Like Abdul Basit was telling me about how he loved... he said, there's a book by Shakespeare that I really like. Hmm. And I'll tell you what it's called, Mike. It's called Hamlet. He spelt it out as if I never heard of it. And he adored that book.
My guest is Mike Thompson of the BBC News. We're talking about his new book, Syria's Secret Library. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is BBC News journalist Mike Thompson, whose new book is called Syria's Secret Library, Reading and Redemption in a Town Under Siege. You can join our conversation now by phone. And first up, we want to hear from Donna calling from Frisco. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Chris. Mike, this is a wonderful show, and I'm envious of you for getting to go to Syria. I wanted to know what your opinion is, if you have one, on some of the independent journalists such as Eva Bartlett, Vanessa Beely, Tim Anderson.
In what regard, Donna?
I've got friends, honestly, who are on both sides of the divide who are very supportive of the three of them, and I think there's maybe a couple of more. And I've got friends who say that they are basically the Putin apologists and that they're not, their narrative is false.
Yes, well, there's so much of that, of course, because you get that anywhere in politics. But when you've got a war going on and the stakes are so high, you do get that a lot. And I've found at times I've been called an apologist for Al-Qaeda or ISIS or whatever for doing this book and for talking to these people, all of whom, of course, had nothing whatsoever to do with groups like that and are fiercely opposed to them. But yes, that does happen because President Assad has tried to paint all those who oppose him, especially anyone who is associated with people who picked up guns, as terrorists. And he sticks to that, and he's called all the people in Deraya were allegedly terrorists, and as now he's saying of all the people in Idlib. And of course, there are some of these terrorists, but they're a very small percentage of the overall number of mainly civilians in these regions.
What did the Assad regime know or suspect about the library?
Well, it's not known exactly how much they knew, but people were convinced that if they did find out about it, they would destroy it. Because I asked them that, you go to such lengths to keep this place secret. And they said, look, if they know about this library, and we think they do, they will know how much inspiration it gives us, how much it keeps us going, how important it is to morale. And they said to me, they bomb hospitals. They bomb hospitals principally because they want to completely reduce people's faith in being able to carry on, and the community spirit and the feeling that life now would not be possible anymore. So they break your spirit. And if they knew this, where the library was, they would know that was the key to breaking our spirit.
People in Daraya, when you were speaking with them during this time, would repeatedly ask you, like, where is the international community? Why is no one coming to help us? I mean, how do you answer a question like that?
It was so difficult. I was constantly asked that. A little later, less so, I got fewer questions like that, but to start with, a lot. And in fact, when I first started talking to people in Daraya, they were really hopeful that having talked to me and the interview going around the world, that would mean that things would change and help would come. And sadly, of course, it didn't. And I tried to explain to them that the big concern of many Western leaders is that although people like them were hoping for democracy and civil rights and a society pretty much like our own, there were others, quite strong entities within Syria who might seize control, who had links with Al-Qaeda or ISIS. And that was the big worry. But they kept saying, but look, if you act quickly, these groups won't gain traction. Don't leave it. And of course, by the time things went on, these particular groups got more and more powerful and more of a threat. And the people of Daraya and many other besieged areas started to realize that help they'd so long hoped for wasn't going to come.
So how did Daraya's resistance to the regime come to an end?
Well, finally, people that I was talking to were squeezed into this tiny pinprick of an area of Daraya. The Syrian government forces had closed right in. They'd taken over all the farmland, which was providing food for the town. And people were huddled in this tiny area, which also, of course, meant that casualties grew because of concentrated populations. So when it was bombed, more and more people were dying. And eventually, the council and the military people there decided that there was no point in trying to fight on. And a deal was reached, quite an unusual one, really, which you saw replicated in places like Aleppo, where people who had resisted the Assad regime were allowed to leave, and those who were fighters were allowed to actually leave with their small weapons, their small arms, and be evacuated to Idlib province, the last rebel-controlled area of the country. But eventually they had to give up, and there was such desolation. And of course, amongst the people I spoke to, one of the biggest things, and I never imagined this would be the case, their biggest concern, apart, of course, from their families and their close friends, was what was going to happen to the library. That was something that was... what I'd like to do, if I may, Chris, is read you just a short extract from Abdul Basit, who was talking about this very subject, and how on the last day he had gone to say goodbye in the cemetery to friends who had died. He'd gone to his family home to say goodbye to the place he grew up. And then he said, when I tell you what I did next, please don't think that I'm crazy or shell-shocked or something, but this is what happened. Knowing this might be the last time I would ever see the library, I walked over to the shelves and I hugged the books. I hugged as many as I could. And when I did this, I cried. I cried a lot. Then I walked around reading the titles on the spines out loud and flicking through the pages of some of them. I so wished I could take all the books with me, all of them. I feared they'd be burned or destroyed in some other way. And of course, they weren't allowed to take any books out with them, just only a change of clothes and a small amount of personal effects, which were inspected by the Syrian soldiers.
Thinking about how close these people became, surviving together over this number of years, working for each other and also to keep this library going, the diaspora that came from moving them out, I mean, on the one hand, they were in a marginally safer place. On the other hand, they had lost so much community.
Indeed, they had. I mean, they did all reconnect. And in fact, I was at when the town was evacuated, I was in the early stages of writing the book. And suddenly I was faced with not knowing where all these people were, because they were all bussed out to unknown places. They didn't even know where they were going. So I talked to some before, but they had no idea other than somewhere in Idlib. But because of this sense of community, which did seem to transfer itself, not entirely, because as you say, when you lose your hometown and the cohesiveness that gives you, it's much reduced. But still, there was this great feeling of camaraderie and closeness which connected everyone. And very soon they were back in touch with each other and giving each other support. And again, the library, even at that point, I thought, now they've had to go to a whole different place they've never been before, a strange area. They've no roof over their head. They've no guarantee of what they'll eat next. They've no one that they can count on to help them in this new place. They surely won't care about the library. But again, it was one of the first things they talked about when I got back in touch. They're asking me, have you heard what's happened? What's going on with the library?
Hmm. Were you able to give them any information?
Not initially, no, because Daraya was pretty much deserted. And it was only, in fact, when a CNN crew who had heard a radio documentary I had made about the early stages of the siege, who managed to get into Daraya, and they set off to see if they could try and find the library. And they actually, a bit of a spoiler alert here, but they did manage to find out what its fate was. And it had been dramatic, and it was something that had been feared for a long time by all of those who created it.
Hmm. I mean, it's so interesting. You have, in this story, are the stories of people who are being killed, people who are starving, people who are angry enough to kill for the cause that they believe in, the side that they believe in. Why do you think a story like this, anchored around a library, touched so many people in your broader audience in a way that the sort of relentless coverage of bombing after shooting after siege didn't quite penetrate?
It's such a good question. It's something which, in fact, I asked myself, and I also, because I've been thinking to myself, this was of sort of 30 years of journalism. This was the story which inspired me more than any other. And yet here it was in a war zone where there was so much death and destruction. But I think people seeing individuals who don't just survive, they prosper. They build on their community, on their relationships with each other, on their knowledge, and they plan for a better future, all while chaos and hell is happening around them. They just didn't give up. And I think that's one of the biggest things for all of them, that they felt that because of all this, they'd risen above what was arranged against them. And many of them didn't fight at all. Many of the people who created the library never actually manned the front line. They were just spending their time trying to plan for a time when the killing had stopped and they could help rebuild their nation. And they were so proud that they'd overcome their own fear and almost a feeling when you're frightened of not wanting to do anything, just sitting there and shivering, was how many of us, and I don't know, it might not be myself, might react. So I think it's that touched so many people, and this and also this love of literature, this absolute adoration for literature, poetry, science, geography, history that prevailed. And again, if I can read just one very short paragraph from Abdul Basit, who talked about the secret library, just to give you an idea of the love he had for it. It gave us a precious space where we could breathe hope instead of despair. It liberated us from suffering and savagery. Inside its walls, the love of science, literature, and ideas filled the air. This symphony of books soothed our hearts. As we entered, its aura revived us like fresh air to a suffocating man. It was the oxygen for our souls. It was a place where angels met. Every time I stepped inside, I flew with them. And when I read that, I thought it was, you know, amazing. It was just so full of passion and love. And there was so much which happened all the time, so much good grace and a lack of bitterness and positivity about the world despite all they'd been through, that I thought that was hugely moving. And I think, in answer to your question, I think that is a lot of what so many people who've read this book have picked up on.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you think, Mike, that kind of survival, without bitterness and with great resolve and sort of a sanguine desire to just thrive as much as possible in the worst conditions, do you think that's something people can choose, or do you think it's something they are born with the ability to do or not born with the ability to do?
I sort of wonder whether perhaps it's something that's in all of us, but it needs bringing out, and it needs the people who can bring it out. And I think there was enough of a sprinkling of those people in Daraya, because many of them, like Sarah, the teacher, she said to me, I'm not brave, when I talked about the bombing and how she carried on looking after the children and never seemed to care for herself. And she said, I'm not brave. In fact, I'm very shy. I'm quite withdrawn. But because I find a bigger cause in looking after the children, in helping with the library and in keeping our community together, it helps me forget my fear. But she said, I can't imagine if I hadn't had these people, these influences around me, that I could have done that. And I think maybe that's it. And that's another reason why it inspires me and gives me hope, that perhaps we're all capable of this. And it was just a group of people here just sort of showing the way.
Where is Amjad today?
Amjad is living with his parents, still with his family. And the last time I spoke to him a few months ago in a suburb of Damascus, his family didn't go to Idlib. And because he was very young, he was allowed to go to a more normal civilian area. Anyone otherwise who didn't agree that they supported the government and that they didn't support the revolution, the uprising, if you weren't willing to testify to that, you were sent to Idlib. Only if you said, I have no problem with President Assad's regime and I'm against the uprising. And of course, many families with children that for so long had been in such terrible danger and suffering, they just wanted to get them somewhere reasonable. And I can imagine most parents would feel they'd probably say the same.
Anyone I've ever spoken to who has spent time in Syria apart from the war has described such warm people and such extraordinary culture. Is there hope for building that back?
Well, of course, at the moment, it's hard to have hope because it looks like President Assad has almost won his war, and around half the population is either displaced or refugees living abroad. And rebuilding it could cost $250 billion, it's estimated, and few countries coming forward with that money. In fact, no country is currently coming forward with that money. But having said all that, when you see what we were talking about, the sort of the way people managed to survive in Daraya, and they've still got all their hopes and dreams intact, even though they're living in now bombed Idlib with a very uncertain future, they've still got that. And I believe if people can have that, I think the country can recover.
Journalist Mike Thompson is a reporter with BBC News. His book is Syria's Secret Library, Reading and Redemption in a Town Under Siege. Mike, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter @KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.